We are now recording to the cloud. So welcome all to tonight's Q&A session. We are recording the deck, the recording, and the chat window will all be posted on our website sometime probably later on this evening, courtesy of all the hard work that Alan does. And so for tonight's presentation, we are going to start off with Bob Walker. And so, Bob, I will turn it over to you. And you can share your screen and lead us through the start.
Okay, let me just get this up and running here. Okay, tonight we're going to be looking at an e-reader buying guide. Now, a while back, the club asked if anybody had any applications or other information they'd like to share. So I shared the book discovery service. People put in the comments there several other reading resources and stuff. So I did a second presentation on e-reading resources, which included other places to get e-books free or at a discount, or getting e-books at the library. Plus had a look at the Caliber e-book reader and library manager. That ended up leading to a little presentation on ebook file formats, which led to ebooks versus paper books. So hopefully this is the final episode so far in what's turned out to be a series. And this is the e-reader buying guide. Now, the first thing we're going to look at is what are some alternatives to e-readers? And the big one is free apps are available from Kobo and from Kindle or Amazon. For reading their ebooks on computers, tablets, and smartphones. And while the Kobo and Kindle ebooks can't be read on each other company's e-readers, both of their apps can coexist just dandy on your other devices at the same time. I have both the Kobo and Kindle apps on my laptop and my smartphone, and it's just great. Now, the computers, tablets, and smartphones can display images in color and at reasonably high resolutions. The e-readers can't. And we'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. So why would you want an e-reader then? What's the big deal? First of all, most e-readers use e-ink screen technology that makes the screen look like a paper page. And this reduces eye strain, and it reads like a real paper book. And e-ink is a brand that have several different paper display technologies. Now, unlike the reflections you get off computers, tablets, and smartphone screens, the high contrast touchscreen on the e-ink display eliminates pretty much all the glare. Even in direct sunlight. And I'm sure we've all been there trying to look at our smartphone screens out in sunlight, and you can't see it hardly anything. It's particularly annoying when you're trying to take a picture or something with your smartphone. However, the e-ink technology that's used in most readers' current models has little or no support for color. They had color screens for a couple years that some e-readers had, but the let's just say it wasn't very satisfactory. It's sort of the kindest thing you can say. The other thing is e-readers don't need power to maintain the page of text. So you can do an awful lot of reading on a single charge. Now, if you use a backlight to read in dim light or in the dark, that reduces your charge time quite a bit. But the dedicated e-readers also allow you to indulge in your love of reading without getting all these social media email alerts, text messages, and push notifications that bother you whenever you're on your other devices. And using e-books opposed to paper books helps save trees. Now, when we're reading from screens like TVs, computers, and all that sort of thing, most people tend to skim and dart over the content, and because they're constantly hunting for the specific thing that they're after. And this is sort of called surface reading. And this is from a report from the Stanford Center for Teaching and Learning. However, when you're reading from a paper book, your brain switches to a more concentrated form of information processing called deep reading. And it helps you better absorb and comprehend what's on the page. And that applies even if it's a digital page that mimics the real thing. And it helps you concentrate better. Now, in terms of market share in Canada, Kobo, which is the Kobo ebooks are sold through Indigo Chapters and Kohl's. They have 45% of the dedicated e-reader market. Kindle, which is an Amazon product, has 25 to 30%. And Sony, which is now discontinued its e-readers, was a distant third place, and this was a few years ago. And the balance is shared by a number of other brands. Worldwide, Kindle has about 54% of the market, and Kobo is in a distant second at 14%. And that's last year's statistics. So I'm going to focus this buyer's guide on the Kobo and Kindle e-readers that are currently available in Canada. In terms of features to look for, some models are waterproof, so you can read in the bathtub, and if you drop it into water, they're not going to be toast. And if you're reading out on the patio and leave it on the table and it starts to rain later, it's not going to be damaged by the rain. You're not going to go scuba diving with these. They're only good up to 60 minutes in 2 meters of water. And you can expect over time the little flap that covers the charging port there isn't going to be quite as waterproof. So you got to take that into account. All the models have touch screens. Some of the models, the deluxe models, have page turn buttons. And you see on the picture there, the buttons are down the side. And if you turn them to use it with your other hand, the page automatically swaps over to suit it. And any of the models that have the page turn feature can also operate in landscape mode if you prefer a wider screen. All the models that are currently available in Canada have backlighting, so you can read in the dark or in dim light. But studies have shown that evening exposure to blue light from backlit screens like tablets, smartphones, e-readers, and that can suppress the body's production of melatonin. And this is a naturally occurring hormone that helps the body fall asleep. So on some of the computers now, as well as the e-readers, the backlight can be set to reduce the blue light in the evening. Now, some of these blue light filters that are available on the e-readers allow you to adjust the color temperature and the intensity of the filter, and some have a timer, so it automatically starts to decrease the blue light as evening approaches. The Kobo models have OverDrive support and integration, and OverDrive is the ebook system that most libraries use. Kindle does not support OverDrive in Canada at this time. And this is the information as of about a week ago, and that could change any time. They do support OverDrive in some areas of the United States. However, you might find that the library only has a very few digital copies of the most popular books available, so you may have to wait months or even over a year to get the book you want. And they don't allow you to renew the digital copies, so you have to read them in the allotted rental time. And for current bestsellers, that might be as short as 7 days. And for other books, that's usually 2 to 3 weeks. Some of the Kindle models have audiobook support, but you need a Bluetooth headphone or a Bluetooth speaker to take advantage of that. And there are some issues with Kindle support for their Audible audiobooks in Canada. And the information I have as of last week is you may need an American Audible account to access this feature. And I didn't do a really deep dive into this because I wasn't that concerned with the audiobook support. If you really want to use audiobooks, your smartphone, your tablet, your computer, the Amazon Echo devices, et cetera, may be more suitable platforms for listening to audiobooks. When Wi-Fi is unavailable, some of the Kindle models have basically what amounts to cell phone support. And this is paid for by Amazon. Now, that doesn't mean you can use your suitable Kindle device as a cell phone, but it will allow you to get on the internet and go to the Amazon website and browse and download books. And you can access Wikipedia and some other sites as well, because there's a sort of a vestigial browser in the device. Now, both the Kindle and the Kobo have a big range of accessories available for their products. And that includes stands, covers, covers that turn the e-reader off when you close them, covers that turn into stands, and all sorts of stuff, and all sorts of fancy designs on the covers themselves. And there's even a little device that has a little strap down the back so you can hold it in one hand easier. Now, I've said here there's six models available in Canada. I put the 11 in there because some of the models are just the same model but with different option sets. Pretty much all of them have a screen resolution of 300 pixels per inch except for the Kobo Nia. And the Kobo Nia, it's the cheapest one of the lot as well. It's basically last year's models held over, and I expect that once all the current stock is sold out, it'll be discontinued. For $20 more, the Kobo Claire is a much better deal. And you can see from there the different options. The main option features are the amount of memory. 8 gigabytes of memory holds hundreds of ebooks. 32 gigs of memory holds hundreds more. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. And then there's the Kindle Paperwhite and Kindle Oasis that have the 4G LTE feature. They're all pretty light, all in the same basic weight range. It has a weight in grams there. And for the metrically challenged, I put along the bottom there that comes out to 0.44 pounds. Now, there's other models that both companies have available in other countries. And if you shop around, discontinued models may be available at a discount. Both the Kobos and the Kindles are sold by Amazon. The Kobos are sold by Chapters Indigo. Both companies' models are sold at Best Buy and at several other places, so you're not limited to just Indigo Chapters or Amazon to get your models. The information I have here is as of 15th of March, 2021, and techreader.com has a really good e-reader comparison review on all these models, so you can get a lot more details. In terms of disaster recovery, if you lose or sell your e-reader or if it dies, all of the Kobo or Kindle books can be reloaded from their website from your Kindle account. And those stay there basically forever, according to what the companies say. However, if you load any EPUB or other books you've acquired elsewhere onto your e-reader, they'll be lost unless you have backups. You do have backups, don't you? Chris and Alan have given several presentations on doing backups and everything, so you should be well prepared for that. Now, both companies have what I would call proprietary library services. Kindle Unlimited and Kobo Plus Read services are each available for $9.99 a month Canadian. And that gives you access to more or less a million ebook titles, as well as a selection of magazines each month. You can borrow up to 10 books on Kindle or 15 books on Kobo with no time limit. But the caveat there is you have to sign into your Kindle Unlimited or Kobo Plus Read account once a month to keep it active on your device. Because once you cancel the account or let it lapse, all the ebooks you've borrowed disappear off your device. Now, you may think that a million or so titles sounds like a lot, but most of the books are from self-published authors and small publishers. They're not necessarily current bestsellers. And most major publishers won't allow their current and recent bestsellers onto these services for obvious reasons. So you have to do an awful lot of reading of second or third tier books to make it worthwhile to have these services. But both of them will give you the access to the service free for a month to see if you like it or not. So get your reading in real quick. Now, there's a couple of gotchas here. The Kindle e-readers and apps do not support the very popular EPUB format. The Kobo does. And as you covered a couple of presentations ago, EPUB is sort of the selected format for getting a lot of the free e-books and books from the library. The Amazon Kindle, much more than Kobo, really tries to corral you into their Amazon ecosystem, and they really don't like you getting your books anywhere else. They do have a service through Kindle where they provide some books for free, but it's not really a biggie for them. You're better off doing it on your own and trying to get them elsewhere. And that's about it for tonight. Let's see. Stop share.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. That was really good. So I don't see any questions. So I think if people have questions, we can cycle back. Oh, is Michelin says, is PDF supported?
Yeah, they both support PDFs.
Okay, we can cycle back to this if questions come up later on.
If you go back a couple of presentations and go to the OPCUG website there, the presentation on ebook file formats, it lists what file formats each of the two reader brands support, and it'll give you some ideas there.
Okie doke. So I think with that, then we will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the rest of tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and thanks very much, Bob. I was heartened to see that was the final episode so far. So that suggests to me there might be more one of these days.
Well, if I get a lot of questions and all that sort of lead themselves naturally to another episode, fine, but as a result of Bob Harris's excellent presentation a couple weeks ago on the Wyze cameras, I might start doing a little bit of a series on smart home technology.
That would be cool.
So we'll see where that goes.
So everybody send your questions on smart home technology to Bob Walker. Okay, well, we still have a number of items pre-prepared. So first off, Chris had asked me whether any of the units last week I was talking about Veracrypt, and I mentioned that And the VeraCrypt file container doesn't update its date timestamp when you change the files inside it. And I needed to do that in order to use Free File Sync to make the backup. And so I use this Unix utility called touch, which is an executable file from this this group of utilities. And Chris had asked me whether there are any other utilities that might be of interest to people. So I thought, I took a quick look, and here's the answer. If you search for Unix utilities on Google, the two main hits you'll get are the Wikipedia listing, which gives you a list and descriptions of all the utility programs in this package, and a link to SourceForge, where you can actually download the software as a zip file. Now, when you download that zip file and you unpack it onto your system, it creates this this file folder called Unix Utilities. But you still have to deep dive into the structure, because you'll find that the actual programs are buried about four levels deep in this wbin subdirectory. However, if you look at the Wikipedia listing, here are all of the utilities that are in that subdirectory. And down the bottom there, you'll see touch.exe, which is the one that I frequently use. If you look at some of the other utilities in the list, you'll find that some of them are labeled as dummy. And for example, the chown command. This is a Unix or Linux command, which is used to change the ownership on a file, change owner. Now, the problem is Windows and Linux use different file systems, typically, and so the same command, the same Linux command, doesn't work in Windows. So in Windows, you do this as an administrator, because you can go through the graphical user interface and change the ownership. Or, who knew, there's actually a command line program called takeown, which will let you do the same thing. So that's the Windows equivalent command, so you don't need chown in the Unix utility, so they don't provide it. The other thing that can happen is you can get a program like date. So Unix utilities gives you date.exe, but you have exactly the same command in Windows, which does exactly the same thing. It shows you the current date and time if you want, and allows you to modify it. So again, since you have the exact same command in Windows, you don't need the Unix utility, even though in this case it's provided. However, there are some utilities which could be useful, like diff. Diff is a Linux command which shows you the differences between two files. Usually these will be two text files, is the way I use it, and it shows you side by side how the two files differ. And I just note here that I actually demonstrated how to do that using a Windows utility, the Notepad++ program, and the compare add-in, which gives you a graphical way of doing it, which to my mind is actually superior. However, here's the diff command with the help option activated. And as with a lot of Linux, Unix type commands, you have a simple command, but then you have a million switches, so you can make this one command do all kinds of different things. So for example, if you were to use the command in blue here, diff minus y minus suppress common lines file 1, file 2, the Y switch tells the command to output the results in two columns side by side, and the suppress common lines obviously suppresses any lines which are the same in both files. So if I run this command on my qindex file, text file, and the old version of it, you can see that on the right-hand side there, some of the listings for today's Q&A session are in the new file, but not in the old file. So that's one way you could do that using Unix utils. But again, Windows has the FC command, the file compare command, and it does basically the same thing. By default, it does it in line. It doesn't do it side by side. But if I run that command on the same two files, you can see at the top of the screen, I've got the old file, just gives me a date. And at the bottom of the screen, it's got the new lines plus the date where the two match. So that same command does the same thing as diff. And here's the program which I talked about. And if you look at my Strongbox folder, this is the one that I used as a Veracrypt container. It's dated March the 18th, 03/18. If I run the touch command, then you can see on the bottom that the date timestamp changes to the 19th. So I've done it at almost 9 o'clock in the morning. And by touching the container, I've updated the date timestamp. However, again, you can do the same thing using Windows commands, but this time you have to dig a bit deeper. Who knew, for example, that copy /b strongbox plus ... would all that command would do? It doesn't copy anything. It actually updates the date timestamp to the current date and time. Or alternatively, if you're a PowerShell user, you can use the bottom command where you get strongbox and change its date timestamp to the current date using the getDate function. So if we look at my file here, strongbox, if I use the copy command, you can see that all that really happens is it changes to March the 19th at 9:01 a.m. You remember before it was something like 8:54 a.m. So it's updated the date timestamp by about 5 minutes. And by the same token, if I use the Windows PowerShell command, then the date timestamp gets updated to 9:06 a.m. So there's no real advantage to touch, except it's a much easier, in my view, it's a much easier command to do what I want. However, if you're interested in these Unix utilities, there are 118 of them altogether. Typically, they have a lot of different options, and you can use these to create quite powerful commands. However, as I said, most of these commands can be reproduced using either Windows commands or Windows apps. And I give you the example of Notepad++, which rather than use the Unix find command, it has really powerful search and replace commands. And rather than use the Unix diff command, you can use the compare plugin. However, as I mentioned, I think some of the Unix utilities are what I would sort of call elegant. So personally, I'd much rather use touch.exe than worry about that PowerShell command.
One thing I'll point out too, Alan, is that the number of switches on all of these commands in the Unix utils allow for much, much more customization in how the program actually operates than the equivalent in Windows. So.
Well, Windows does have some switches, of course,
yeah.
But you're probably right. Unix probably has more.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's an interesting package. Basically, the Unix commands ported to Windows. So if you need any of them, they are available. Okay, Chris had mentioned membership in the club, and I'll just remind everybody about our special. If you're not a member or you have a friend or a relative who wants to be a member, if they join before March the 31st, and now that's only 1 week away. In fact, our next Q&A session will be on March the 31st. So if I show this slide next week, you'll have hours to join rather than a whole week. But basically, because we're extending paid-up members by an extra year as of March 31st, anybody who joins before March 31st is going to get 2 years worth of membership. Well, they're $20, so that's a really good deal. And I see Chris has just posted the join link in the chat window. Okay, our next follow-up is from Chris.
Yeah, so I gave a presentation on using KeePass as a password keeper, and one of the things that I talked about in there was the ability to have KeePass Droid on your phone, your Android phone, and ways of keeping your password database synchronized between your desktop PC and your Android phone. So I did recommend KeePass Droid, and it does work. But I actually found something that worked a little bit better, or quite a bit better, thanks largely to Michel Lesseau, who pointed out that the KeePass Droid doesn't actually support attachments on your Android phone. So my example of keeping your passport photo on your in your KeePass database and on your phone so it was available, well, it turns out that you couldn't open it on your phone anyways. So we both found the same better solution than KeePass Droid. So why not KeePass Droid? So the main one, which I think is it's actually fairly important, is the idea that there's no attachment support. And I really thought I tested that, so my bad on that. But more important, I think, maybe for most people getting things set up is how to get automatic synchronization of your database going between your phone and your desktop. And it was somewhat tedious, a little bit difficult, quite a few screens you had to go through. It worked, but it would be different for every cloud service because basically KeePass Droid is just looking to a local file on your phone and you had to use something else to do the actual synchronization. In my case, because I use Google Drive, well, there is Drive on the phone, the Android phone, and I was using it to take care of the synchronization. Also, I found that the user interface in KeePass Droid is not the most modern-looking, clean interface. It worked, but it wasn't all that pretty. But it did work outside of the attachment issue that I talked about. So we both came up with KeePass to Android as a replacement one. It has a much better looking interface. It does support file attachments, so as long as you have an app on your phone that will handle the particular file format that you've got in your database, then you can open it on your phone. Synchronization is really nice. So you could do it manually with a local file the way I showed before, and that works. You could do a manual setup syncing with Google Drive the way that I showed it, and it would work, as tedious as that would be. But it also includes automatic synchronization, which is real easy to set up and use, and it works with many different cloud services, which is really nice. So when you open up KeePass to Android, you get an option to either open up an existing database file, or you could create a brand new one if you don't have one. So if you choose open file, it brings up the next screen. And if you're using a local file that you've just copied over to your Android phone, you can just use that system file picker, which will let you point to anywhere in the file system and open up the database file. Or you can pick a cloud service, and you can see there's a lot of them. Most of the major ones are there, you know, Google Drive, OneDrive, Dropbox, and so forth. So there's an awful lot of services that you can just point to and select. And when you do select one, in my case, I selected Google Drive. And so the first thing it did was I got a prompt. So what account do I want to actually use on the phone to synchronize with a Google Drive? And so kind of neat, you don't have to use the one app or one account that you have on your phone typically, which in my case is like a Gmail account. You could actually add another account and synchronize with the Google Drive for that other account if you wanted. So I would just select my one that I do use, which matches the Google Drive app on my desktop. And then I get a prompt for, do I want to allow KeePass to Android to actually modify files in Google Drive? So that's just a security thing to make sure that I'm allowing this particular app to do that change. So you give that permission, and then it brings up your My Drive on Google Drive, just how you would see it if you were to go to the web. and access Google Drive on the web. So you just drill down. In my case, I have a folder called KeepAsk, and in there I have my ctaylor.kdbx file. So I point to that, click on it, and basically that's it. I'm done. And I think any of the other cloud services should work as smoothly. Now, one thing that's kind of neat is that if you change your database in two places at one time, so you have it open on your desktop, you have it open on your phone, and you make a change to the database in both places, what's going to happen on that? KeePass to Android actually does understand the concept of multiple devices. And so it will actually offer to reconcile the differences between the database records. And if it was a different record that got changed on each side, then it'll actually update on both copies of the database the changed records, which is kind of neat. If you have the same record gets changed on both of them, the most recent change is going to win. You do get prompted. So you can say, no, I don't want this to be reconciled. And so then you have to work it out yourself. The KeePass on the desktop doesn't understand the idea of multiple devices at all. It just uses whatever file it points to, and it's going to just happily use whatever it finds when you open it the next time. And I think, the last one here. So KeePass to Android, what it does is if you make a change, it will write it to the master file in the cloud service, if that's what you're using, immediately. Okay, so if you have Google Drive installed on your desktop, it'll actually get updated directly onto your desktop immediately as well. And when the desktop copy of KeePass loads the next time, it will load the new database. Okay, and what it does when it reads stuff, though, is it reads off of a cached copy. And that's how it knows when a change has been made on the other copy as well as the copy that's on the phone. It can see, because it's reading a cache copy, that is different than the version of that's on the cloud service. And if that happens, that's when it will allow you to synchronize the changes between the two of them. So my best practice, I guess, on that is if you use KeePass to Android, if you think you made changes somewhere else, KeePass to Android is just going to read the cached copy unless you tell it to synchronize. And so for that, you just go to the three-dot menu in the top right, tell it to synchronize the database. It will then do that compare of the cached copy to the cloud version and offer to reconcile the differences if there are differences needed.
Two questions or comments.
Yep.
John Fleming says, my low-tech approach to KeePass on the phone is to email the database to myself and download it on the phone so there's no cloud involved.
Yep, that can work fine. And that's similar to the manual synchronization method that I gave in my presentation on using KeePass in the main part of the meeting. So emailing to yourself is basically the same thing. And if you're using KeePass to Android, basically what you do at that point, rather than pointing to one of the cloud services, you just tell it to open that local file, and that works.
How does it reconcile? Which one wins?
Yeah, and so that's what I said in the previous slide, where basically on the phone side, it will actually look at the record level. And so if it's different records that got changed, it will reconcile them right all the way through. So if there was a changed record from the desktop, it'll get changed in the phone side. And if there was a change on the phone side that was different than the desktop version or the cloud version, it'll reconcile that up to the cloud. And so on that, it does it completely cleanly. If you happen to edit the same record on both databases, then it'll basically offer to say you want to keep the most recent change, and but you can back out as well and just tell it, no, I'll worry about this, figuring it out on my own and reconcile the differences myself. Okay, one other thing that they have on there, it was questioned about at the main meeting where I talked about KeePass, is the idea of autofill of passwords and usernames on Android. And I haven't tried this, but Android 8, which was Oreo, it did introduce Android autofill. and I think it got a lot better in 8.1. KeePass to Android is a supported password manager using Android Autofill. And so if you are interested in having that, so that when you're on the phone and you're logging into a website, that you can have it look up your username and password in the Android or the KeePass for to Android database, then it can be done, apparently. And I would suggest looking at the link on there for more information on how Autofill actually works. And I will actually paste that into the chat window as well. As I said, I haven't tried that, but it's supposed to be supported.
Tom says, which is author of Autofill? There are several.
The author, you choose it based on what's on your phone. And so if you say you want to have Autofill done, if you have KeePass to Android installed on your phone, it will show up as a selectable option in there. It will show all services that have advertised themselves as being able to do Autofill. It's not so much that it's part of the Android itself. Android will just apps will actually register themselves with the operating system saying they can do Autofill, and so Android just happily gives you the choice of apps that have advertised themselves as such.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Chris, people, lots of choice.
Yep.
Okay, so before we started, I think Bea was mentioning that because we were asking for scam alerts, she hadn't seen any in the last week. So we're obviously doing a good job keeping the guys at bay. But just remember, if you do get any interesting scam messages or telephone calls, we'd like to hear about them. And we'll be looking at these at the Q&A on April the 7th. I got one the other day, actually. Here's a SMS text message that came in, and there's a couple of great big red flags there. Firstly, it's an unknown telephone number, not one that I know anything about. The second thing is they want me to click on a bit.ly link, and those short links usually are hiding a malicious website and somewhere. However, if you look at the message a bit more closely, NSF should be Médecins Sans Frontières. And whoever sent this knows that both Carol and I are at the end of this telephone. So that kind of got me thinking. So I went to 411.ca and did a reverse lookup, but that doesn't help because 411 can't find the address or the sender, the owner of that telephone number, so that's a bit odd. And then I looked at the Bitly link, and sure enough, the link actually is genuine. It actually goes to an msf.org webpage. However, the moral of the story is send MSF a nasty note saying, don't send such silly messages which look very much like spam. So take me off your distribution list, please. Anyway, if you receive any scams in the next couple of weeks, please send us something to the regular suggestion box email address. Next thing I have is a share. Again, Chris, he's always making work for me, this guy. He says Audacity might be interesting. Maybe you could do something about Audacity for us. I forget why we were talking about Audacity, but it's a sound recording program, kind of a sound studio. And it turns out that they've just released version 3. So I thought, well, that would be interesting. I'll just download that and make a quick mini presentation on how to use Audacity. So I copied the files down to the C drive and install the program. And then I created a shortcut to the executable, so and use that on an icon on my desktop, and I ran the program. And Windows Defender pops up, and their smart screen utility says, whoa, wait a minute, we don't recognize the author of this app, and so don't run it. Or you want more information. Well, I'd like more information, please. And so it says, well, Audacity.exe, but it's an unknown publisher. And run anyway. Well, okay, I can run anyway. The problem is, every time I run Audacity, these screens pop up and I have to bypass the screens. Well, it turns out you can actually work around this if you go to the program folder file on the C drive, right-click on the executable and choose properties. And when the properties box comes up, at the bottom of the screen there, you can see the security line, and you can check on the box marked unblock. So unblock the security for this this program. And then that prevents the Windows Defender kicking in and complaining all the time. Or at least it would do. Except when I uncheck the box, and when I check the box rather, and I run the program again, now I find I get an error, and apparently too many posts have been made to a semaphore, which is a wonderful error message for somebody. It turns out this is actually a Windows system error. For all you Windows geeks out there, this is system error number 298, but that's all I know about it. I've got no idea why it occurs, what it means, how to get around it. But Chris will tell you, well, when in doubt, you should always complain to somebody. So go to the feedback hub and complain that, hey, you've taken my nice utility program and won't let me run it without jumping through all kinds of hoops. And all I know is that a week ago I sent it and I know that they've got it. And usually that's as far as I get with Microsoft, but that's just me. Anyway, there's another workaround. The other workaround is to download version 3 on my Linux box, because Linux is perfectly happy to run the new version of Audacity. So when I have a few minutes, I will actually run Audacity on the Linux and come up with a few slides. And it really doesn't matter in terms of the functionality of the program. And it works basically the same on both platforms. Usually it's easier to set up in Linux because it figures out things like sound cards much easier. Anyway, that's for another rainy day.
Natalie has a question. I have the older version, Audacity 2.4.2. Will I have issues if I update?
I suspect you'll have that issue, Natalie, the Windows Defender kicking in, because I had 2.4.2. I had to uninstall it in order to install 3.0, and what you see is what you get. That's what happened when I run Audacity 3. Personally, I wouldn't do anything for a while. Just let it be and see what happens. I'm sure if you're not doing anything wild and wonderful with the sound recorder, the old version will work just fine. I've been running that version for quite a while. Okay, moving along. Stuart sent us this share for all you poor people who are working at home, or all you poor people who are still working. YOW Canada, an online training company based in Ottawa with a focus on health and safety. And Stuart thinks that all you people working from home might want to know about current requirements. And these people have some training courses, and one is health and safety awareness training. And another one that might be of interest is office ergonomics. And if you go to the link on the screen here, you'll find all of their courses, including the two aforementioned ones. And even if you're working from home, you might want to try golfing from home. And Bob Harris sent us this one, WGT Golf. This is a game, a program, available in Windows, Apple, and Android versions. Now, you have to register, which means you have to give them your email address. You have to give them an email address to register, but it's free to play. And Bob tells me that you can play it with other people who are matched to your specified skill level. I guess you say what your skill level is, and the program goes and finds other people who can play it at that level. Or he says you can invite a whole bunch of friends to play around. And he's tried to rope in Chris and I, but Chris and I know just about as much about golf as we do about rocket science or whatever. But Bob says the graphics on this program are beyond impeccably perfect, and as is the sound whenever you hit the golf ball correctly, which I take it doesn't happen all the time. And here's the impeccable graphics. I can't share the screen with you, the sound with you, but I'm a bit worried about Bob here. He's teeing up, but isn't this the golf ball right here, Bob? It's kind of 2 feet behind your club.
That's actually me playing golf.
So you want to add anything to about WGT golf?
Oh, sure. I'm not a golfer. I bought golf clubs 40 years ago. I don't like playing golf. I bought nice clubs, but then I played a few times. What a waste of stuff. But I hit this game, and I really wanted to share it with you folks. As Alan said, the graphics are just phenomenal. The sounds are all there, too, when you hit the ball. It shows you the wind. It shows you how far the hole you have in front. It's 146 yards and up 3 feet. And the club I'm hitting right now will hit 160 yards. So don't hit it quite too full. But I played this game for a bit. I have it on my desktop, have it on my tablet. I can play one or three holes while I watch TV. And I really encourage, I play to people all over the world. I logged in yesterday, and I'm top right. You see, I'm Bob from Canada 1. And the country flag is up there, too. So I'm playing yesterday, last evening. I think I'll join in and I'll play three holes. There's always several thousand players that want to play with you. And it matches you to the player of your skill level. So you start off beginner. Don't worry. There's beginners at your level when you join in. So the guy says to me, where are you? The chat. It's optional chat. Where are you from? I'm from Ottawa. He says, well, I'm from Ottawa, too. Anyway, he was in Richmond, the guy was, like 10 minutes from me. We exchanged names, and I have new friends. You can also play with people you know. And once again, the graphics are just – and, of course, my avatar has been edited since this screenshot. You can change your avatar. Now, many of you folks haven't seen me since March of 2020. But I encourage you all to join me on golf and see my avatar. Now, I'm looking really good these days.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob.
It's a great fun. You can pay for it, but it's totally free. You do not have to pay. And it's all iOS, Android, desktop, the works.
Okay.
Need any help, call me or send me an email. I'll help you get set up. It's great fun.
Okay, very good. All right, so we're at that time of night where we're asking, are there any other questions out there? Comments or things you'd like to share?
You can either enter them in the chat or unmute yourself and ask them audibly.
Tom says, walking's healthier than sitting, but if you want to sit, try bridge base. They take it, that's the bridge, the card game.
Yes, I'm actually a director of a bunch of tournaments and the runner of a club that runs about six to eight tournaments a day on bridge base. So if you like bridge, you can play for free, or you can play for ACBL Master Points or other prizes. So if you're interested in bridge, if you haven't heard of Bridge Base, I think you're probably brain dead, but but just in case.
Okay, well, while we're waiting to see if anybody has any other questions, let me just start on a few slides here. If you've seen the current issue of the newsletter, you'll find that there's a couple of articles in there. One in particular is asking for speakers. The board of directors is looking for ideas for topics, for sessions, for monthly meetings, for members' favorites, for Q&A. And we're also looking for speakers. So if you would like to give a presentation at any of those venues, or if you know of anybody who has a topic that would be prepared to give a presentation to us, computer related, of course, then send the information into suggestion box. So that's just general topics and certainly specific ideas for speakers. The next cafe is yours truly going to be talking about Android smartphones. And don't get too excited. This is essentially the same presentation I gave to the club a few months back. So if you saw that one, there's not going to be anything new. In fact, because it's only an hour presentation, I took a few slides out. So it was a bit less than there was before. But if you're interested in smartphones and Android in particular, I got some comments that might be of interest to you. Our next Q&A session will be next week, March the 31st, so send in your specific questions about anything computer related to the suggestion box. And Micheline is asking about double-sided printing setting. I think this was a message in the user forum where Micheline went to the printer settings in Windows 10, changed it to double-sided printing, printed something, and then next time she came into the printer, the settings had reverted to single-sided. So if anybody knows how to make settings stick on printers, personally I've never had that problem. I don't have a double-sided printer for one thing, but usually the settings I do set and it stays set, so I don't know what the problem is. And the same thing with the keyboard setting. Yeah, there was something about, I think Micheline uses US English International, and it keeps reverting to US English. And I've certainly seen that. I've had it change to to English UK, and then suddenly the apostrophe doesn't work or the semicolon doesn't work or something like that. And I've had to dig into the settings and change it back. But again, usually it stays set. Jocelyn says that usually all you have to do is change the default settings. And Tom says, I recall vaguely you can set up different settings and save them with different names. But that's only a vague recollection, I guess. So if anybody has any ideas on how to make settings stick, you can always answer Micheline's messages in the members forum. Or, again, send it to suggestion box, and we can do a follow-up next week. Okay, so we're 2 minutes ahead of time. I don't see any other questions there, Chris.
I don't think so. Just going back through here. No, I've been watching it fairly closely, and I don't see anything else really that question related. A few comments here and there, but that's all. Yeah. I think that's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it, and don't forget to put in your questions for next week. And your ideas for topics and speakers, please.
Thanks very much, folks, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.